Duncan Artis,
I
the
see.
new Chief Investment Officer designate, because he only takes over in September. Dave, before we ask Duncan about various bits and pieces on his new role, have you got anything to, now that he's going to be the guy who looks after these gazillions that are entrusted to Alan Gray?
I'd like to share because I'm a great Alan Gray follower. I mean, I get all their documents, etc., and they're true to where they've always been, and they've always had a very specific style of investing. And you're going to ask Duncan as CIO if he's going to move off this path or whether he's still going to remain loyal to the way that they have always managed portfolios, especially in the kind of environment that we find ourselves now.
Good question, though. Are you still going to remain as the adherent to value investing?
Yes, so we've been doing the same thing for almost 46 years, 47 years. And I think most asset managers that are independent of a life company or investment bank don't last that long, right? Because asset management is just a business of people. Some people move, some people start fighting. You have periods of underperformance. And outperforming the benchmark is hard over long periods of time. So, what's worked for 45 years, would you want to change it? No. But we're always making incremental changes. And I think if you look in South Africa, I would say now each incremental unit of alpha, and what I mean, each little bit you outperform is more valuable than it was when I started. I think there are a lot more good competitors, and the South African equity market has got a lot more sort of, as I say, competitive over time. So every little incremental improvement you can make to your process. A good example for us is fixed income. I mean, people think of us as equity and balance managers, but our best performance over the last year has actually come from our fixed interest portion of the portfolio. And we've spent a lot of time improving the process. So it's all about improving processes.
There's been quite a lot of criticism of Alan Gray in the last little while, not just from Magnus Hastak, but from others as well.
I've
Has
never heard of
that
him.
relative performance, did that impact the change there?
No. So, I mean, Andrew's been at Alan Gray for 20 years, same length I have, and he's looking to do something different. As a CIO, you have a 1-year notice period. I've known about Andrew for a long time. And then what happens is the CIO recommends a successor to our remuneration committee, the chairman of which is Ian Little, my former boss as well. And so that's a very structured process. It's just how do you announce these things? Because we were going to announce it in March, but then the virus came. We thought, well, Andrew's only leaving in September, so why do it now? And the performance has really been dragged down really by, I'd say, the last 15 or so months. I mean, if you look 2017, 16, 15, 14, 13, we had alpha in every single one of those years. So it's really just last year and this year that's been tough. And that obviously can drag down the longer term numbers. If you think at the moment a good return could be 5 and a bad return 3. And the difference between the two is very small. And then the other big part of it has been Orbis. So I mean, as I mentioned, the shares you and David have been speaking about, they very, very underweight the US. They very, very underweight disruptors. And I think you would know the sort of disparity between value and let's call it growth is about 3 standard deviations or something. So we actually think the best part of the performance is actually probably going to come from the offshore for the portfolio if any mean reversion happens.
Is it a mean reversion when you've got exponential companies growing at the rate that?
Yes. Let's think of Microsoft. It's a $1 trillion company. Let's say you want a 20% return. You have to add $200 billion of value. So they have to find a new profit stream on a 20 multiple that makes them $10 billion profit. And if you start looking through Amazon and Apple, just to make a difference to the valuation, they have to take over entire new industries just to make up for some kind of growth. Because in reality, Facebook and Google are advertising companies. Advertising is cyclical. At some stage, digital advertising reaches a certain level where it doesn't take any more market share. And then what are they, right? And I bet you if they're that big, then whoever is US president or is ever head of the EU ain't going to allow a few US companies to rule the world. So typically, these companies have always been taken down by regulation. Are they fantastic businesses? Yes, they are. Do I think everybody owns them? Yes, they do. And do I think they're on big absolute valuations? I mean, is Amazon going to be a $2 trillion company, a $3 trillion company? Whereas if I'm looking like something like Nedbank in South Africa, I'm just going to use it as an example. No one wants to own an EM financial stock. I think Nedbank's worth 100% more than its current share price. Does it get there in a straight line? I have no idea. So I just think that everyone's kind of positioned the same way.
Duncan, I've got a table on or a graph on the table here. I'm sorry, it
Sure.
didn't work out as well as I thought it
That's
was.
fine.
But on the left-hand side, it talks to your main holdings in the portfolio.
Yes.
Given what you told us a little earlier, Is it likely that these aren't going to change too much when you take over in September?
Yes, so I think it's very important for everyone to remember that there are four managers who manage the balance fund. Andrew, myself, Ron and Jacques. It's only Andrew who's changing. So then we are promoting Tim, Akka and Rory. Tim's been at Allengrey for 7 years and Rory 12, so very experienced sort of people. So remember that the chief investment officer at Allengrey doesn't tell everyone what to do, right? But you do need someone who's ultimately responsible that the board and I guess clients can look to. I'll be managing a slightly bigger slice of the money than I used to, but the vast majority of the fund is still going to be managed by the same people who've managed it the last 5 years. And remember, we've done this transition over a number of times. Simon Murray was CIO when I joined, was passed over to Stephen, and then Ian, and then Andrew, and now to myself. So we don't have individual people who run funds. It's sort of a multi, sort of internal multi-manager approach.
That's extraordinary. So in all that time, 20 years, there have only been four of you as the chief investment officer.
Yes, well, five now with me. And then it's even more remarkable if you think about the impact Simon made. He was only chief investment officer for 3 years. It doesn't feel like that when you think back. Remember, Simon moved to London to go and help with Orbis. So a client, we've always had a lot of client meetings the last day, and one of the more people I respected, you know, he never expects anyone bad to be promoted at Allengrey. And that's because we've got this very, very thorough process, difficult process that people need to get through before they can get to a level where we promote them as portfolio managers. So we've actually managed transitions like this pretty well in the past. And at least we can point back, as you said, to history and say, you know, yes, some good people have left, but then there's always been someone else who's taken over who's been good across the whole team. And that should give clients a lot of confidence.
How are you growing your timber? How are you growing the next Simon Murray?
So it's the same sort of process we've used. So what we've typically had is, you know, we've got the portfolio managers at the top. In fact, this is probably the most experienced people we've ever promoted in the firm. So people start at the bottom as an analyst. I mean, you expect us to cover many different sectors. We don't believe in having sector specialists. You know, you write reports. And then, you know, as you get advanced in the team, you know, there's more expected of you. And then analysts get to manage something we call an ARL, which is a paper portfolio. So their main job is still to be an analyst. They're given a very real life 10 billion rand portfolio that trades off the prices and the volumes. And, you know, we have a long track record for people who we're going to promote about how they manage money on that paper portfolio. And also there's, of course, a qualitative thing to it. How did the analyst handle telling Investec CEO they're way overpaid? Or how did we deal in situations? And, you know, we've got a long track record of reports, what shares they recommended. And of course, you know, managing money, as I'm sure David knows, is a lot about EQ as well, right? If it was just up to clever people, everyone who ran money would be a Harvard professor, right? Actually, there are lots of good people who've made money who are not necessarily the best people at numbers. A lot of it is managing the emotions and, you know, when you go through underperformance, like how do you react to it? And so we take all those things into account.
How do you manage your emotions? Given what we've learned from Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, you don't have to be a rocket science, which aligns with what you said a minute ago, but you have to be able to keep your emotions in check.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you think long-term capital management was run only by by all the guys who won all the awards for derivatives. Yes, Alec, I think the most important thing I can say is we always say if you took an average investment team and you put them in the Allengrey structure, they produce above average results. So it's actually not me. It's the structure and, you know, what is your ownership structure? Does it allow you to take a long-term view? How are the incentives of the portfolio managers linked to the outcome of the clients? Do they just get big bonuses even if performance is bad? And, you know, I've lived through a lot of cycles. I've tried to read just about every great investment book there's ever been. And that's the amazing thing about investments. Great managers are willing to share what their thoughts were. So it's kind of the structure and the process is there. And then obviously some individuals act slightly differently each time, but you know, that's up to each sort of individual in my point of view. But it's the structure and the process and the ownership that to me is far more important than having smart and hardworking people.
How did you handle Sasol? I remember we've spoken about this in the past. The share price jumped all the way down to 20, 21 rands. Yeah. You guys were big shareholders, then you were selling. Did you get back in at 21 rand?
No, we didn't get back in at 21. Like we bought a little bit, but I think when you look at Sasol, there are two things to think about. One is when they had the second cost overrun, we reduced its risk weighting. What do we mean by that? We couldn't buy more than a certain level in the portfolio because you realize, well, if you have another $1 billion overrun and you times it by 15, it starts to become big numbers in rands. And of course, you know, you're relying on chemical prices and oil prices to bounce in the short term, which you just don't know, right? Even though they have. And then you also have to think it from another point of view. It's not clear yet. The chances are obviously getting less where the oil price and chemical prices are, but there was a chance Sasol needs a rights issue. And if it was a distressed rights issue, it wasn't going to be a small amount of money. So if you had 1 rand in Sasol, you didn't really have 1 rand. You had 1 rand plus the extra money you had to put in. So we were thinking, when you think of position size, if Sasol was going to have a rights issue, how much do we want to own now? And then, you know, what, where would it be if we have to put more money in? It's a strange world. I mean, if oil goes back to 80 and chemicals, Sasol could be back over 300 rand. So it is pretty remarkable. Even though it's gone up 6 times from the bottom, you know, you still sit with the same sort of problem that if the oil price and chemical prices collapse again, you know, in the short term, you do have this 190 billion rand of debt. But they have said, or there've been news stories, that people are looking at buying a stake in Lake Charles. You know, if they can sell a stake for $2-3 billion, you know, that's sort of $45-50 billion of debt you can repay. And then the company starts to look a bit different. So we just apologize to everyone out there. If I think in the last 10 years, you hopefully don't have shares like this more than once every 10 years.
David, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago about Sasol, you made the point that it was a day trader's delight. And that it certainly moved me enough to get it out of our portfolio. I see the share price has been whipsawing a little bit around these levels. Would you be recommending to Duncan that he piles back into Sasol now?
Not at all. No, not at all. When we said it was a day trader, it was US day traders. They suddenly got the Chesapeake, I don't know what it was, move, and decided that this is where they're going to throw their daily money. I mean, it just became crazy. I'm on, you know, from my point of view, there are too many issues there that we have to negotiate to make it an attractive buy, which we can't negotiate. One is the oil price, chemical prices as well. And also one has to look at management, how this whole thing has been management, the manage, you know, the cost overruns and so on. So I don't want to look for trouble. You know, I'm in a different camp, whether it's value or not value. I just, to me, there's too many things around Sasol to make it attractive. The difference between Duncan is that I have to look at my clients in the eye. I don't do it through a third party. You know, they sit at me around the table, and if I lose their pension, it's hell. So you've got to be a lot more careful when you put people into things.
Although David, I must say, the safest share in 2000 was Dimension Data.
Yeah, a good point indeed. Looking people in the eye. Do you look at them in the eye at all? Surely you would have certain people that you have to please explain
sure.
to.
I think I did 65 client presentations last year. We go from the biggest pension funds in South Africa to webinars with 1,700 people. Now, trust me, we look the clients straight in the eye. And people have a very high expectation of us. Sometimes when you do well, it's because of Alan Gray. When you do bad, it's because it's Duncan. You know, so we need to manage those sort of processes.
Well, congratulations on your appointment, even though you knew about it almost a year ago. It's nice to be able to talk to you again, Duncan, and look forward to picking up with Alan Gray in the future. Before we say goodbye to you, how big is Alan Gray now? What kind of asset base are you looking after?
So it depends which week you pick at the moment, but it's around about 500.
500 billion. Rands.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. But remember, a fair chunk of that is managed by Orbis.
Duncan Artis, the Chief Investment Officer Designate from Alan Gray. Lovely to see you again and to have you on Rational Radio.